Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Aaron Maddox of Coramdale Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about harmonizing the gospels. And guys, first of all, thank you for holding out, especially the Gospel of Matthew, most recently in Coramdale Church.
Thanks.
And Aaron, I'm continually grateful that you're a part of the team. I remember, Bob, years ago, we would be like, you know, maybe a week to 10 days out on a sermon. And because of the thoughtful work that you guys have been doing and others who aren't in the room, we've been able to get further down the road.
We're quite a ways out, which is good.
Yeah. And it's been great. So
it's been awesome.
Love it. Thanks, guys.
Hey, before we tackle that subject, I want to remind our listeners, as I said last week, that we're going to take a break between February and April. So February 18th will be the last Wednesday Conversation episode you'll see for a month or two, and then we'll relaunch on April 15 with, some new features, including including video.
Yeah.
So get ready to see Dusty White's beautiful face.
Gotta dress up on your phone for the occasion. You know?
You know what Aaron Max is going to be wearing for the video podcast?
A red shirt.
Nope, definitely not red. Black, baby. So harmonizing the Gospels, this topic did come out of our study of Matthew. It's one of those things, Dusty, when you suggested this podcast, you were like, hey, why don't we do one of those cutting room floor podcasts?
Yeah.
That's our shorthand for when we're doing sermon prep, so much just ends up on the cutting room floor. It's just like, well, it's not going to make it into the final sermon.
Yeah.
But it kind of is interesting. And if you've been a listener for a while, we did some of these podcasts when we did Genesis, because there's so many interesting questions in Genesis. This is another thing that comes anytime you're preaching through the Gospels, right? You have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So you've got four Gospel accounts. And specifically Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, share a lot of material in common. And so frequently, as you're reading the Gospels, you know, Matthew will tell the story one way, Mark shades it a little bit differently, Luke tells it a little bit differently. Sometimes they add or leave out various pieces of detail. And so it can be really challenging to know, especially as a new Bible reader, well, man, why are these stories different? And so two things to say at the very beginning. One, obviously the church fathers knew that, like, this is not a new problem. Everybody who's ever read the Gospels is aware that, like, oh yeah, Mark's account is slightly different than Matthew's and so forth. So Christians have been thinking about this problem for centuries, and that's part of why Aaron's in the room, is because there's a good long history of how the church has dealt with these questions. But two, this has always been one of the best sort of like apologetic levers against Christianity, is to say, well, because these accounts are different, either some of them are inaccurate or untrustworthy. This has always been a place where critics have leveraged their critical nature against Christianity. And so for that reason, it's important for us at two levels. One is just so we can be intelligent readers of the Bible, but two is apologetically, you might have friends or family members who bring this up and say, hey, this is a reason I can't trust the Bible, or I don't want to be a Christian, or I'm not sure what to think about God because of these kinds of questions. So Aaron, recently, I was preaching Matthew 8 a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Here's what Matthew says in chapter 8. I'm reading from the NIV right now. Verse 28, when he arrived at the other side in the region of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men coming from the tombs met him. Mark says, they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. So immediately in these two verses, we got two guys in Matthew, but only one guy in Mark. Matthew calls it the Gadarenes. Mark calls it the Gerasenes. Are those two different places? Did one of them mess up the... So what do we... I thought that was a great place to start. Well, here's a very clear... Just let's start with a text that sort of brings the problem to the surface. So there's a text for you.
Yeah.
Where do you want to jump in and just helping us think about how we sort of make sense of some of those questions?
Yeah, I think maybe a good place to start is just kind of zooming out, big picture. And just first understanding, okay, what are we reading as far as the type of literature that's in front of us?
And that's what I like about you. You always want to start with, what is this?
What are we looking at? And I think, you know, it's somewhat obvious we're reading one of the Gospels. And I think sometimes we miss this, though, that the Gospels are a particular genre of literature. And especially when you think about what a Gospel or a biography would have meant in, say, the first century, there are certain literary conventions that are in place there. And I think maybe to put it most simply is that when we as modern people tend to think of biographies, we want kind of exact details that correspond exactly to, you know, how things happened. And while I do 100% believe that the Gospels are reliable eyewitness historical testimony, the conventions that say Mark or Matthew are using, there's a little bit more, we might say, freedom for them to maybe highlight certain details here, or maybe have certain things at in a different order than how we might in a modern biography. And that's not them being facetious or like playing fast and loose, but that's them just kind of inhabiting the writing style, if you will, of the day, of what it meant to write a first century, you know, biography. So I'm not scared at all or like alarmed when I see that, oh, you know, Matthew has this or Mark has that. That doesn't change anything as far as this is God's word. This is God's inspired word. This is something that is historically reliable and based on real historical events and things that actually happened in time and space and history. And at the same time, to your point, as far as you raising up kind of this example here in Mark and in Matthew, yeah, there are questions that come up from that. And that's good. We shouldn't ignore that. We shouldn't pretend those aren't there. But I do want to help someone, if they're asking this question, to start with, okay, maybe the assumptions I have about what it means to write down a biography or write down history may be a little different than the conventions that Matthew and Mark are using. I think one way I've heard it put that's pretty helpful is that the Gospels are not just video camera footage, as if
that's
they're
good.
Exactly recording, you know, say what's happening outside, you know, this room right now. They're not less than recording historical events and things that happen, but they're also doing theology. They're also trying to shape you as, in this case, a disciple of Jesus. So there's virtue, character formation that's happening. And of course, the history part and the reliability part as far as the events are also really important too. So,
okay, that's helpful.
It's also helpful, right, to keep in mind that these different gospel writers are all in different kind of professions,
yes,
or places of society.
Oh, for right? sure. Yeah, and just they're different, you know, backgrounds as far as to your point, Dusty, of, you know, Luke being, you know, well-trained and a physician and someone who's maybe a little more intellectual, you know, relatively speaking. And we don't necessarily know you know, Matthew is a tax collector, we know that, but, you know, what was Mark's profession? So they're coming with their different backgrounds, their different abilities and skills as a human author to what they're putting forth in written form.
Okay, cool, Aaron. But Matthew still says there's two guys and Mark says there's one guy and this really happened in history. And so there was either one guy or two guys. So what do we do with that?
Well, let's think about this. I think this is where, people have thought really hard about this. This didn't scare, to your point, what you mentioned a moment ago.
This was the first time, this podcast.
It's the first time anyone's ever seen this problem.
We're such a gift right now.
Right, yeah. As if, we're the ones to discover an error in the Bible and we can't trust it. And, we kind of say that tongue in cheek, but to recognize there is a long tradition of well-read, intelligent people who've looked at this passage and others like it, and it has not diminished their trust in God's word. So that's, again, really important to emphasize. I think with something like this, and there's other instances that are similar to this where there's a detail where there's, say, two characters here and only one here. I think of the empty tomb with the angels is another example.
Yeah, good.
One thing that I think to maybe back out and just use an analogy, we often do this in our own storytelling and ways of communicating things happening in our own lives. So just recently, we were with some friends watching the Seahawks and 49ers football game. And people were asking me, hey, who did you watch the game with? Or what was that like? And I said, we were watching the football game with so-and-so and they're 49ers fans. And I was saying, we watched this game with one family. But at the same time, there's actually another family that was there who really had no buy-in to the game.
They just weren't 49ers fans.
They weren't 49ers fans. So like there were two other families there. But in the context of who I was talking to, I only needed to talk about that other family to kind of draw out.
Because your point was their team lost.
Their team lost and we won. Right. And so we're better, you know?
And to tell you about the other family doesn't help my story.
It doesn't help. It doesn't, you know, it's not that they might be listening to this. We love you. but as far as how we do this all the time, my point is we do this all the time and how we talk about, you know, what's happening in our lives. There's certain details we want to emphasize or highlight. Hmm. And it doesn't mean we're lying or we're playing fast and loose, but in order to kind of communicate the point, we say certain details here, leave out certain details here. So it's very possible, you know, scholars, as the more than likely case, is that there probably were two demon-possessed men, and for whatever reason, one of the gospel authors wants to highlight one as maybe being either more disturbed or like more in charge or something along those lines. But that doesn't, only talking about one does not mean there's not the second one.
Yeah.
That's kind of a simple way to put it.
It's a great example. I think, you know, to use a really tense example recently, right? The ICE shooting that happened in Minneapolis, right? There was a lot of people involved in that, but the news accounts focused on the one ICE officer and the one woman driving the car. And that's kind of, if you only read certain accounts, you would think there was just two people.
Two people, yeah.
But actually there was a whole, you know, there's a whole bunch of people around. So that's a good example or a good analogy, Aaron, to remind us that we don't just have two separate accounts and either one is right and one is wrong or the other is right and the other is wrong. They're emphasizing different things. And probably one maybe has a reason for only highlighting the
one character.
Yeah.
I read one thing that's a very simple phrase. This one scholar put it like this: omission is not denial. So to omit the one is not to deny that there was that other one there.
That's good.
So
that's good. Okay. What about like, you know, place names like this, Gadarenes, Gerasenes, you know,
that feels important.
Did one guy just not know how to spell? Is one guy, you know, he thought it was Milwaukee, but really it was Detroit. What's going on here?
This is some manuscript issues.
So, I mean, there is. I mean, if you have, you know, your ESV is going to have a footnote there and to talk about there are textual variants that some of them do. Some of the manuscripts in Matthew say Gadarene, some say Gerasene. So there is, that's a whole rabbit hole that we could go down. So leaving that off to the side for now, I do think what potentially is the most probable thing happening is that if you kind of do the geography and do some homework on Gadarenes and Gerasenes, so on and so forth, the region of the Gerasenes is kind of thinking about it in like concentric circles. So the Gerasenes are kind of like the broader region and the Gadarenes are maybe the more kind of local or specific region. And so maybe another analogy that can be kind of helpful with this is, you know, sometimes when I'm meeting someone new and they're asking, you know, about my own story or where I'm from or whatnot, a lot of the times I will say, I'm from Seattle. And I live 2 hours north of Seattle.
You're not from Seattle.
I'm not from Seattle.
It's from the region of
from Seattle. From the region of Seattle. And it's because my hometown, Linden, no one knows where that is. Except for actually two people, actually, in Cormdale have real side story, but they have family from there. But most people don't know where my hometown is. So I will just say I'm from the Seattle area. And that's not me, again, lying or anything like that. And I do think, and scholars have pointed this out, that's probably what's happening here is that one of the gospel authors is using kind of the larger region to talk about, you know, in the country of the Gadarenes, whereas maybe Mark or the other gospels are using a more specific, kind of more localized region. So again, there's differences, of course, in the names, but they're not saying something that's contradicting one another. Mm, right. In some ways, it's kind of complementing one another.
Well, I was even thinking about the nature of how, one of the fascinating things when you do geography of the New Testament is how frequently place names change and how languages change, right? So think about this. This is a simple example I was thinking of in our lifetime. When I was a kid, the city in India was called Bombay. Now we refer to it as Mumbai because Bombay was the English colonial way of reframing what that city was. But the Indian way of saying it is Mumbai. Those words are kind of similar.
Sure.
But actually they start with a different letter. They're spelled totally differently. And so if you think about like, that's the same city. We're referring to one city. But if you read a text from 1950 and someone called it Bombay, that would feel totally normal to you. And if you heard a current resident of India say, I'm from Mumbai, that would you'd know what they were talking about. But if you had those two things on a piece of paper, you'd be like, well, those don't seem like the same place. And that happens so frequently as cities rise and fall, as empires come and go, as places in the world that have been there for hundreds or thousands of years are, you know, as they are taken over by new cultures, those place names can get sort of convoluted in even the textual issues you're talking about. A lot of times what you have is a scribe working with a 500-year-old text and saying, oh, well, now we call that place this. And so he's going to amend the text, not because it's wrong, but because his readers aren't going to know where that place is unless he clues them in sometimes by a gloss or sometimes by a textual note to say, this is where that's talking about. And so we have all these manuscripts and that's what scribes are often doing is trying to locate a place by what it's called now or how their readers would make sense of it.
Yeah, that's good.
What else is helpful, Aaron, as we just think, not necessarily about Matthew 8 and that particular question of the demoniacs, but just broader, you know, like you said, these harmonization kinds of things come up a lot of places in the Gospels.
Yeah, there's a couple, you know, for lack of a better phrase, like kind of easy ones to kind of explain. I think Sermon on the Mount in Matthew and then say Sermon on the Plain in Luke. Some people go, oh, like, why are these different? And I think that's a pretty, you know, clear case that probably is two different events in the course of Jesus' ministry. And he said similar things on different occasions. And so there's several examples like that throughout the Gospels where because the wording's not the exact same, it's very reasonable to suspect that Jesus as an itinerant teacher is going around and he has
using the same sermon.
Yeah, he has a body of work that he's kind of refining, or not refining necessarily, but he's working through and communicating in different ways to different audiences. And so Luke recorded one version, Matthew recorded another, and there's no contradiction there. So
never have I ever repeated
preach the same sermon. Yeah.
So on level, that's kind of an easy one. I think most people would get that. I think where sometimes it gets tricky is when people might notice, like, hey, certain events are not happening in the same order in each gospel. And it might be very similar stories, but the ordering's different. And that's where I would go back to some of the things I was saying before. Like, the kind of literature that a gospel is doesn't necessarily have to be what we might consider video camera footage from timestamp 0 to, say, timestamp 20. So that's part of just the nature of literature. I think an example of this that we often do in our day, at least our family does, is that I was just kind of looking through my phone because, you know, they wanted me to do the iPhone update, and then there's no room on the wasted like
delete 90, some stuff.
Yeah, I have to delete a bunch of photos. And, you know, looking through our photos, yes, those photos are in chronological order of how I took those photos. But in our family kind of photo book that we do every year, you know, my wife does a great job of putting that together. But those photos don't always go in chronological order. They're often grouped thematically around like key events, or like, hey, these are photos from when we're at the beach, or these are photos from, you know, this trip. But again, they're maybe more thematically arranged. And sometimes that's what I think what the gospel authors are doing when we might say, hey, those events are out of order. There's maybe a theological reason that he's grouping, say, Matthew, these certain events together, or why John is grouping these things together, or wanting to highlight this certain aspect of Jesus' ministry. And that's, I think, just a normal, fair thing for someone in the first century to do that's writing a biography. And I think we do something kind of similar. That's maybe not an exact parallel example, but something that is I think, relevant to our day of, like, how we tell our story is often done thematically, or we highlight certain things. I think even when, you know, recently in Intro Gospel Community, we went around and shared our kind of 2 or 3 minute version of our stories in our little small groups. And there's ways where when me and Shai are sharing our story, we're condensing certain things down and highlighting certain things depending on the audience we're talking to, versus when we're in our regular gospel community and we're sharing our story, we're going to elaborate on certain things and highlight certain things kind of depending on who is in the room. And that's not, again, I don't think we're being facetious or lying or anything like that. And then when someone comes over for dinner and we're getting to know them and we have a lot more extended time, again, there's certain things that we're going to highlight or maybe camp out on in a different manner. And so that, again, maybe that doesn't satisfy everyone's questions on why certain things might be in different order or worded differently or things like that. But hopefully that gives a little bit of a window into this seems reasonable.
I have a question there because this one's just fresh on my mind because I was studying it recently. In Matthew 4 and in Matthew 9, there's that verse where he says the same thing. Jesus went throughout their towns and synagogues, you know, teaching, proclaiming the gospel, healing various diseases. And most scholars would say those two, the fact that that exact verse is kind of repeated is almost like a bookend. Or a marker.
Yeah.
And what's in between there is the Sermon on the Mount and then a bunch of healing stories. Yep. And so is that an example of Matthew's probably taking all these healing stories and grouping them, not necessarily chronologically, but because the reason he's telling them in chapters 8 and 9 is to sort of show you Jesus teaching and Jesus healing.
Exactly. That's a great example of that. And paying attention to the literary movements of the particular gospel is really going to help you on that, or the phrases that the writer is using as these bookends to, hey, this is a section, a thematic section that's highlighting Jesus' teaching in the first half and then Jesus' healing ministry in the second half. You know, and Matthew's going to do that all throughout his gospel, having these bookends. You're going to have like a section on parables. And did Jesus say parables only in Matthew 13 at that point in his ministry? Maybe. Or maybe Matthew grouped them together and he's not, again, playing fast and loose, but he's wanting to highlight in this aspect of Jesus at this point in his gospel. And that's okay for him to do that.
Yeah, that's great.
Back to Matthew 8, do you think, so like Mark, it struck me that Mark says about 2,000 pigs, whereas Matthew 8 just says like many pigs. 2,000 to me is a lot.
Seems like a lot of pigs.
Do you think it's because Mark is trying to emphasize to a certain like audience of mathematician, marketing, you know, economist? Or something
that's
like
a
that.
Good question.
Because a lot of pigs to me, many pigs to me is like 200.
Yeah, 100 pigs is a lot.
Yeah. I mean, off the top of my head, I don't actually know why, you know, 2,000 versus many. Yeah, it's a good question.
Well, and then like in Matthew, he says, you know, the demons, you know, like say, hey, send us into the pigs. And he says, go. In Mark, he says, he gave him permission.
Gave him permission. Yeah.
It's different, you know?
I had this experience. A couple guys asked me in our church when I preached that story of Jesus healing Peter's mother-in-law. I made a point of how Matthew does not mention anyone asking. Mm-hmm. It just says Jesus saw her. And these guys brought up, well, in Mark and Luke, they both mentioned that somebody asked Jesus to heal Peter's mother-in-law. So like you preached it as though no one asked him, but these two accounts say it. And I looked back at the wording of my sermon and it was super careful because I was trying to make clear that what I'm saying here has to do with what Matthew is emphasizing. Yeah. But I realized, ooh, but that's one of the dangers of preaching the gospels is that if you're not really careful with language, you can sometimes, a writer is emphasizing something. And what we want to say is to this writer, he wants you to notice this feature of the story. That may not be because that's the video camera footage of the story. Yeah. It might mean that he wants you to pay special attention to Jesus seeing her.
Seeing her. And I think that's a really good point there because that helps us, at least it helps me think about how do I read the gospels as far as, you know, we have four of them in our Bible. How do I read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? And I think on one level, I want to consistently be reading the gospels, yes, but allowing on the first pass, if you will, let Matthew be Matthew, let Mark be Mark, let Luke be Luke, let John be John, and to allow them and what they're trying to communicate come to the forefront. And then, of course, I think it's great that to have these conversations about, okay, how do these things match up? How do the details square and whatnot? But to remember, it's very likely that, you know, the gospel authors knew of each other's body of work.
Right.
So it's not like...
It's not like they're like, oh, I didn't know Matthew said there was two.
Exactly, yeah. So like they're very much aware of, you know, what we might perceive on the first pass of like, oh, that's different. Those details are different. They're probably aware of that. And yet they're still writing what they're writing, and that doesn't change them communicating something reliable and trustworthy.
Yeah.
And so to honor, it just is, I think it's a very simple way of just, you know, loving our ancient neighbor as ourselves. Let the words that they're trying to communicate what they're intended to communicate. And then, of course, you can compare and do all that stuff. That's great. But I think my point here is let Matthew be Matthew, let Mark be Mark, Luke be Luke, so on and so forth. And again, that's not where you want to end, but I think it's a great place to start.
That's good. You mentioned that, I guess some of this, Aaron, is, yeah, I like your line there, let your loving your ancient neighbor as yourself. Because some of these quote-unquote problems are us bringing our own biases and assumptions to the text.
Yeah.
They're not problems with the text. What I think is like there's a very, it's like a very college freshman apologetic to be like, well, totally. The Bible has these contradictions because, you know, Matthew says two, but Mark says one. On the face of it, yes, fair point in the text.
Yeah.
But if you're allowing yourself for 10 seconds to enter into how the first century reader approached this text, you can see that this is not a scientific problem with the text.
Yes, 100%. I think, I mean, people don't need to go read a bunch of academic books and whatnot, but I think it is helpful to know that there are people who love Jesus, who love the scriptures, who are some of the smartest people in the world, who have done work on this and are very confident that this is not, you know, an unreliable, you know, document because there's these small details that might seem to be on the surface different. And a lot of good work has been done on looking at ancient biographies in the same time period as Jesus and the first apostles. And like these kind of conventions are pretty consistent throughout, and to recognize at the same time that a lot of good gospel New Testament scholars recognize that these are eyewitness accounts of things that really did happen. And so I hope people come away with recognizing that, yeah, just because the literary conventions might be slightly different, that should not and does not undermine the reliability of what these documents are communicating.
Literary conventions and history do not fight each other.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
It's not either or.
Yeah, it's a great way to put it.
Aaron, what else would be helpful just to think about the authorial intent of the Gospels and sort of how we should read them?
Yeah, this is good. And I think one of the things that I want to say for someone asking about like how should I read these Gospels is to recognize that these writers have various techniques that they're implementing. And I think I've tried to like boil this down in like three simple ways that I think say Matthew is using his literary conventions in his day. And there's the first one's kind of the zoom features. Think about like your iPhone. You're able to zoom in on particular things when you're taking a picture. And I think that's a good example of when a gospel author is highlighting one specific detail or one person when maybe there is two in a different gospel account. I think that's just the gospel writer zooming in on one thing. And again, that's not ignoring the reality of other things happening or other people in that, you know, situation or that story. So first one would be a zoom feature. The second one, you know, there's that the panorama feature that our phones have where you're able to kind of capture like a broad swath of things that are happening. And you might miss a few details along the way, but you can kind of see the big picture of what's happening. And I think sometimes the gospel writers are doing that. So I think, you know, a example of this is in Matthew's account of healing Jairus's daughter. There's less details in Matthew's account than there is in the Mark 5 account. And part of that, I think, is to what you mentioned earlier. Matthew has grouped together various healing stories in one section. So Matthew's kind of moving at a little bit faster clip at that point because he wants to highlight all these different healing stories. Whereas Mark is going to slow down and give some more details to maybe highlight a different aspect of Jesus' character. Matthew, I think, is using kind of, you know, to use our language, a panoramic feature to give a broad sweeping picture of what does it mean for Jesus to be, you know, a healer. And then the other one, I've kind of already touched on this a little bit, of grouping things thematically together. You know, my wife, when she makes the photo book, is bundling different photos in different kind of categories, different sections. And those may or may not be chronologically in order. They more or less are, but not exactly. And I think the bundle feature is another way to think about it, of especially on the whole of a gospel, there's probably thematic things being bundled together that each one of the four are doing at various times.
That would be like on my phone where I have the dog album. It's just all photos of my dog. Wow.
You have that?
No.
I'm so proud of it. Man, I just want to say, if I was taking a synoptics class right now, this is the podcast I'd be listening
to. Yeah, absolutely. Right? Aaron, you've done such a good job like giving us fresh, modern illustrations. Yeah. That's helpful to know, like, oh yeah, like the way my wife puts a photo album together, for instance, that's just a helpful picture. Like, you do a good job of taking it out of the academic and giving us like, oh yeah, in our lives we do that too. That's
and helpful. Nobody's going to argue about that. They're just gonna be like, well, of course you did it this way,
right?
Yeah,
yeah,
because this is the uniqueness to this particular focus.
Yeah
As I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, two considerations sort of put this on the radar for me. One is, as just good Bible readers, we want to understand the text we're reading. And so when you're reading the Gospels and you come across, for instance, the healing of Jairus's daughter in Matthew versus Mark, they're a little different. Why is that? And then also apologetically thinking about, yeah, how do you answer, you know, the maybe it is a sophomoric objection, but the objection of, well, you can't trust the Bible because these accounts don't match up, or because there's two angels at the resurrection in this account, but one angel in this account. I think there are those objections out there, and I hope this podcast helps listeners sort of identify, oh yeah, those aren't very material objections. They're pretty weak objections to the authority of Scripture, but you might hear them from a friend or a family member or somebody who's been doing some simple sort of apologetic reading, and it's helpful to have that in your toolbox. So Aaron, thanks for helping us think through some of the questions of harmonization, and especially that category you began with of what kind of literature are we reading. Always really helpful to start there and remember that we are not reading 21st century news accounts. We're reading first century biographies.
2 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, equipped for every good work. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context, and we always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.